For the share of today, we have Fred in the morning. Don't need to be introduced. He's a madman. So this afternoon, we have the other madman, that's Jay Pasikoff. So I'll leave it over to them.
Good morning, everybody. This is day two of our conference, and we've got an exciting lineup of people to speak to us this morning. Our first speaker is Tony Misch. He's a support astronomer at Lick Observatory, and we're going to hear some eclipse history this morning. He's going to be talking about In the Shadow of the Moon, the Lick Observatory Eclipse Expeditions. Tony?
Good morning. I presented these pictures at a number of venues to many audiences, and I usually begin by asking how many people in the room have seen a total solar eclipse. I think I'll pass on that this morning. In fact, the more appropriate way to phrase the question is, am I the only one in the room who has never seen one?
Yeah.
I'm afraid so, yeah. not by design, I promise you. But I came to eclipse studies through the history and through the pictorial records rather than through being hooked by a corona. But I'm quite certain that if and when I have the opportunity to see one, I'll become a junkie very quickly. When I began at Lick Observatory, I was given responsibility for our plate archive, our plate vault on the mountain, not because I had any particular qualifications as an archivist or a historian, but because the Lick plate vault, like plate vaults at many observatories, is in the peculiar position of being nominally cherished but practically neglected. And so when I was handed the key, it was more because nobody else wanted to do it. Well, I'm sort of a nosy guy, and I started looking around. I could have just gone in and dusted every 6 months, but I started looking around, and I found, as expected, star fields and spectra. I think we have probably about 150,000 plates in the archive. But one afternoon, I was looking through a corner of the vault that I hadn't looked in before, and I pulled an envelope off the shelf and pulled out an 8x10 plate and saw this. It was not like the usual star fields and spectra that I was had become accustomed to looking at. I had not heard of the Lick Observatory eclipse expeditions at the time, and so was startled and delighted, of course, to find this picture. And I began to educate myself about the expeditions, and was very happy to find that not only were there over 200 plates of eclipse camps, that does not include the many, many plates of coronas and the many spectra, that in addition to the over 200 plates of camps, there is also reams and reams of first source supporting material in our archive in Santa Cruz, in the Mary Lee Shane archive. As I went through these plates, I became more and more convinced that this was an extraordinary collection that needed to be seen more widely. A few have been published. A couple that I show you today may be well known to you. I think most won't be. Those that have been published have primarily appeared in issues of the publications of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific back in the days when the eclipse had occurred. S.A. Mitchell called the Lick expeditions a splendid series of eclipse expeditions, and he was not, I think, overstating the case. There were 17 expeditions to 15 eclipses total. I think a quick and probably conservative estimate of the kind of time that was invested by Lick Observatory in preparation, the travel, the setting up at the eclipses, and so forth, and this doesn't even include the reduction time of the data, probably at least 10 man years. And this was all for an aggregate totality of less than an hour over the 17 eclipses, and that would have been presuming that there was good weather at all of them, which sadly there wasn't. The LIP was founded in 1888, and by dumb luck or by happy coincidence, the next eclipse to occur was within about 150 miles of Lick Observatory at Bartlett Springs in California in 1889. The expedition was headed by this man who you may recognize, Edward Emerson Barnard, who was one of the original staff members and an observer of legendary acuity, and also a trained and very skilled and very careful photographer. Barnard went with James Keeler, the spectroscopist on staff, to Bartlett Springs, arriving on Christmas Eve of 1888 after having slogged all day through the mud and the rain. And they set up here on the abandoned croquet pitch of the Bartlett Springs Hotel. See, the beginning to get the instrumentation set up. That was totally cloudy. It was raining. It rained up until about the 30th. The eclipse was on New Year's Day, 89. It rained up to about the 30th, then cleared for a couple of hours in the evening, long enough so that they could get their instruments aligned to the stars and check the focus of the photographic plates. But then it closed in again, and as often happened with Lick eclipses, all appeared to be lost, but at the last moment, the eyes opened up, and they got very good images of the eclipse. This camera is of particular interest. This is a Barnard's camera that he constructed especially for the eclipse. It uses a lens here that he borrowed from a telescope, not an astronomical telescope, but one that was used at the observatory to read the levels on our water tanks, which are about 3/4 of a mile distance from the main observer. But it suited him. It had a good he liked the big field of view. He had a good focal length that suited his taste. So he had the carpenter build this box and this equatorial mount, and dragged it up to Bartlett Springs, and with it he took this, among many other images, which may not look so impressive after some of the things that we've seen yesterday, but at the time was an extraordinarily good picture of the corona. Mitchell actually says probably the best that had been taken to date, and not only did it show a great deal of coronal detail, but it also helped to establish photography as the technique for recording coronas and recording phenomena at total eclipses. Up to that point, it had been primarily drawing. That's fine. 89 happened to be one of those years where there were two eclipses. There was the one on January 1st and then another in December. The December expedition, Lick's December expedition, was led by this gentleman, James Schieberle, who was another one of the staff members. He was accompanied by S.W. Burnham, the well-known double star observer. And they went to Cayenne in French Guiana. And when they arrived, this is what they found. They had a great deal of difficulty because of the humidity, especially at the site. Schieberle wrote, "One who has not visited such a place cannot understand the excessive dampness that pervades. Clothes and shoes mold overnight, and nothing seems to ever to get dry except a newcomer whose thirst is perpetual." They found a very interesting place to set up. And this is one of the great pictures, I think, in the archive. You can, as you've probably discerned, not all of these are telescopes, and not all of them are gun emplacements either. There's a mix, and of particular interest in this picture is
right in the middle there. Yeah,
this here.
Looks about 16.
What's that? This is Schieberle's first attempt at large, wide field, large scale coronal photography. He had made an 18-inch mirror, and he had brought it down to Cayenne with the intention of finding there on the ground whatever materials he could to assemble a tube and a mounting for it. Well, it turned out that the local materials were not up to it, and I think he had probably underestimated the difficulty of mounting this thing adequately to track the sun. And though it sort of worked, they got this not bad negative, but as you can see, if you look down at the bottom edge of the limb, you can see that the image is doubled. It's probably due to either poor guiding or maybe shake in the mount, maybe both. Now, there was the next eclipse was in Chile in 1893. It went to Chiboli. There wasn't a lot of money to send a Lick expedition, so Chiboli went alone, carrying more equipment actually than had ever been taken to an eclipse and a Lick eclipse. He had to establish the location of the eclipse camp once he got to Chile, because the maps of Chile were not so good at the time, and so he did what probably any good astronomer in the day could have done. He took a sextant and a chronometer, and he figured out exactly where he was on the face of the Earth, and of course he had knowledge of the eclipse path, and he decided that the best point along that path, easily accessible from the coast, was Mina Barrancas, a mining establishment at about 6,500 feet in the foothills of the Andes. If you look here at this notch, this picture was taken before the camp was set up, and this view was taken from a similar angle. It's difficult to see, but you can see a little bump there. That little bump is Schieberle's answer to the difficulties that he had with the telescope at Cayenne in 89. He had not wasted his time in the interim and had designed and built a new kind of eclipse camera. This is the 40-foot Schieberle camera, which would accompany all of the Lick expeditions hereafter. It is a fixed telescope, as you can see, and the guiding is done by a moving plate, which of course is possible since the sun just doesn't go very far in the few minutes of eclipse. He went to great measures to stabilize it, probably because of his unhappy Cayenne experience. The tripod here at this end holds the lens entirely separately, mounted mechanically from the tube, and then down at this end under this shed is the moving plate holder, and this is Mr. Schieberle himself looking out. A better view of the group. Schieberle, as I said, came alone, and he did at Mina Barrancas what had been done actually at previous eclipses and was done at all subsequent eclipses. Lick enrolled the help of locals who were willing and able to handle some of the equipment. In this case, there were sailors from Valparaiso who came up, and also mining engineers from Mina Barrancas helped out. And you can see Schieberle there in the center with arms, like, so looking very much like the leader of the eclipse. This is again at Mina Barrancas. This is the view. It's a set piece, obviously. This is how everybody would have appeared in their positions at the eclipse. And I think it was taken after a very successful eclipse, which is why you see Schieberle up here leaning, I think, in a very relaxed pose rather than frantic as he probably was in the minutes before totality. But they got some marvelous pictures, probably the best that had been taken to date. Unfortunately, I didn't bring a corona from Chile, so you'll just have to take my word for it. He did write. He built, by the way, he was behind that curtain at the bottom of the camera with the moving plate holder entirely enclosed in what was essentially a dark room, but he had made for himself a little hatch on the top of the thing where he could stick his head up and have a peek at the corona. He wasn't going to miss it. And he did find an opportunity while one of his exposures was going to stick his head out, and he wrote, "No words of mine can do justice to the quiet grandeur of the scene." So he had a chance not only to take fantastic photos, but also to witness it. Schieberle also, I should add that he was in the habit of taking pictures of local color, also sort of established a tradition at Lick to photograph not only the eclipse equipment, but also the inhabitants and the environs of the expeditions. Schieberle, like I think most Lick astronomers, was expected after his expeditions to give public slideshows, lantern slideshows, and talks on the expedition. And one reviewer in the San Francisco Chronicle, following the Chile eclipse lecture that he gave, remarked in a rather what we would now consider politically incorrect way that Professor Schieberle decorated each of his pictures with the dusky Venuses of the Southern Hemisphere. And in fact, from the evidence in the plate archive, the reviewer was correct. Shibley also was given Hokkaido, Japan in 1896. And here again, they were clouded out in Hokkaido, and so one of his dusky Venuses is mostly what survives from that eclipse, along with a few other fantastic photographs, like this one of the 40-foot camera. You can see here that, as in Chile, Shibley found a hillside on which to support the camera, so that the lens would not have to be high up on a tower and consequently less stable than it would be close to the ground. With this picture, I begin to get the sense with these camp shots, not only of a record of scientific expeditions, and I know this is an aesthetic that I am imposing on it, but I begin to see these things as kind of interesting sort of environmental art pieces, sort of moving installations where these peculiar sculptures are moved around from one place on the earth to another and set up, and they even begin to take on some of the characteristics of their environs. This here, for instance, I could be convinced that there's something quite Japanese about the way that the tube is appears. As I say, I think that's my own superimposition. 1896 was the next lick eclipse, and was to take place or was to be viewed in India. This time, the eclipse went to a new staff member, William Wallace Campbell, who was later to become director and who figured very centrally in subsequent eclipses. Here you see him as a young observer at the business end of the 36-inch refractor. He was a spectroscopist. He's seen here with the Brashear spectrograph. Campbell had recently married before coming to Lick, and had dreamed of going around the world with his wife. That's what they'd hoped to do for their honeymoon, but they couldn't afford it, either financially nor could he afford the time as a new staff member. He had, in fact, been offered the 96 eclipse in Japan, but his wife, Elizabeth, who also figures prominently in future eclipses, his wife was pregnant at the time with her first child, and he decided to stay back, and she really got the eclipse. He also got the clouds. Campbell took the 96 eclipse, and he took with him his wife after considerable debate. Elizabeth was unsure whether she should leave her now two infant children and take the really very long voyage to India. It took them 45 days to reach Bombay. And now we get in a plane and we're there in a matter of hours. But 45 days by sea to Bombay, weeks in India, and then they had decided to come back around the rest of the world. And so they were going to be gone for 6 months, and she had two tiny children. But she decided to go. She wrote that she imagined her husband alone in camp in India, threatened by fever, cholera, tigers, cobras, plague, pestilence and famine, battle, murder, and sudden death. And she decided the children were safer at home with the nanny. And so Elizabeth went along. And in fact, she was right on one count. When they did arrive in India, they discovered that the site they had established beforehand for the eclipse camp was having a serious outbreak of plague and would not be salubrious for the astronomers. So Campbell was stuck with the job of finding another spot along the path of totality where the weather was expected to be good and where they could set up their instrument and had access and so forth. The difficulty was he couldn't find a hill on which to lean the 40-foot camera, as had been the custom, and he ended up here at Jur near Bombay, but in obviously very, very flat country. His solution was to mount the 40-foot camera lens on top of a tower and then to build an exterior tower around it on which was supported the tube. He also had a hole dug down in the ground, lowering the plate holder 8 or 10 feet in order that the lens not have to be any higher than necessary. It turned out to work extremely well and was, in fact, adopted as the mounting of choice in future expeditions. This is another one of these set pieces. This is it's labeled as a rehearsal, but I'm sure it isn't. I think it was taken after the eclipse. This is Campbell and Elizabeth here manning a spectrograph, and a variety of others who they found in the area, and who are all seen here together in the required group shot. Campbell is seated there with the largest pith helmet in the group. I don't know if that designated leadership, you know, that you have the largest pith helmet. But he certainly had a nice one. And Elizabeth next to him. And a variety of people, mostly British naval officers from ships anchored in the harbor in Bombay. This gentleman here had the very happy name of, he's a Major Comfort. two Major and Mrs. Comfort. And that brings us to the first slide again, the one that I found to my surprise in the plate vault. It was taken, as it turns out, on a side trip that Elizabeth and her companion who came along, Rowena Beans, made to the village of Wadi nearby. And they began taking pictures. And it appears from the pictures, now I've imposed this series on them, but I think it's probably not too far from the truth, that as they moved around the village, more and more people became interested in looking at them. I mean, here were two Western women in full eclipse regalia with their pith helmets, dressed for cold weather in a very hot country, with this peculiar machine to take pictures. And finally, the entire village got these are, I think, extraordinary shots. They're marvelous historical documents, and we owe a great deal to Elizabeth, not only for the pictures, but also for the memoirs that she kept. She introduced a kind of a humanist aspect to the eclipses that was largely lacking. Campbell was a wonderful astronomer, but was very businesslike. This is the Mamlatdar of Karmala on the far right, the man charged with taking care of the various foreign eclipse expeditions that had settled in the area, and his family. Elizabeth wrote of this visit that they were evidently dressed for the occasion, especially the men. The little grandson had on a hideous Europe suit. And you see here the little grandson in his hideous Europe suit. It's really rather charming picture.
He doesn't look too happy.
1900, there was a North American eclipse at Wollaston. The photographs are neither numerous nor particularly interesting. I'll show you one. It is interesting in some respects. You can see now that though there were hills in the area, the tower mounting for the 40-foot tower and with its pit, accompanying pit, had gone from being a necessity occasioned by the terrain to the standard practice because it had worked so well. Also at the 1900 eclipse, Campbell introduced a very important piece of equipment of his own design and fabrication called the moving plate spectrograph, which ferried a plate along during totality in the focal plane of the spectrograph, and consequently as the moon progressed through the chromosphere and into the lower corona, the plate moved accordingly and provided both a spectral but also a temporal view of the spectroscopy of the eclipse. He did this in many expeditions thereafter, and it turned out to be very, very valuable technique for eclipse science, particularly for the analysis of the chromosphere. Sumatra, in 1901, the first director of LIHC, Edward Holden, had left in disgrace. James Keeler had returned in as director in 1899 and had died within a year. Campbell had been appointed director. She really had left under a cloud because for having been passed over for the directorship that was given to Keeler. Campbell couldn't go on the Eclipse because he had his hands full. He had been very unexpectedly, on the occasion of Keeler's death, made director. But he did feel that Lick needed to be represented at this Eclipse. It was a particularly long totality. It was 7 minutes. So he sent C.D. Perrine, who was actually a secretary at the observatory, who later became a research astronomer. Perrine took some wonderful pictures of the eclipse camp. They're set up here near Padang in an abandoned race course. This is a rather self-consciously composed, but really very beautiful picture. And you can also see what I'm saying about the equipment begins to take on some of the characteristics of the surroundings. And here's the 40-foot tower a little closer up. You can see now that it is dressed in palm fronds. Perrine wrote, "The tropics seem to be made of bamboo tied together with rattan. It was only necessary to buy a small cartload or so of bamboo and atap and a bunch of rattan. Out of these materials, the expert Malay carpenters constructed everything." And they really constructed everything, including this shed. They had actually several of them, under which you can see the bottom of an equatorial mount that had a bunch of spectrographs and other instruments on it. And because this was the tropics, it rained every day around noon and then cleared up. And of course, you had to have the telescopes exposed to the sky for the eclipse. So it was a movable roof observatory made entirely of bamboo. Wow.
Excellent.
Rather a wonderful. I say. Mm-hmm. 1905 had a very favorable eclipse path. It was a very long path, and it touched actually on four continents. Campbell, who had now settled into his new duties and fully intended to return to eclipse work, decided that Lick would send not one, not two, but three expeditions to faraway parts of the path in order to try and get good temporal coverage to attack two problems in particular. One, the question of the intermercurial planet, which had been dubbed Vulcan. And, you know, they would like to take a bunch of pictures around the eclipsed sun and see if there was anything that A, shouldn't be there, and B, was moving a little bit. And the other was to look for short-term changes in the corona. He sent to the western arm of the eclipse the redoubtable astronomer Heber D. Curtis, who some of you may know from the famous Curtis Shapley debate. That's Curtis on the left. At Sandwich Bay in Labrador, it was an outpost of the Hudson's Bay Trading Company, and you can see to the right of that pile of wood, you can see in the distance the 40-foot camera. Here you see it from the backside. You can see also how low in the sky it's aimed. It was at the start of the, or very near the beginning of the eclipse path, so it was the sun was eclipsed in the morning. We also see now another instrument that we haven't seen in other eclipses here. This is the Vulcan camera. It was designed and constructed explicitly to take on the problem of the intermercurial planet. You can see it actually consists of four cameras, which have been rather oddly canted with respect to one another. The idea was that they took duplicate pictures, to eliminate errors from defects in the film. They took duplicate pictures on either side of the eclipsed sun in the plane of the ecliptic, where of course they expected to find Vulcan. I can see that there was a lot of manual operation involved. took five people to run this camera. The shutter man is up here, and the four guys, one for each plate, are down at the other end, and they had to dig a hole for the lower plate, old plate men who had to do their work. Sadly, and not really unexpectedly, Labrador was completely clouded out, so no scientific results were obtained, but a wonderful series, roll around, wonderful series of plates of the area were made. I think they had a lot of plates with them, and after the eclipse they realized that they weren't going to get to use them for their intended purposes, so they took a lot of wonderful landscapes, including this wonderful picture, this beautiful picture that is, to me, urgently reminiscent of the American painter Thomas Eakins. This, which actually is also a little bit reminiscent of Grant Wood, the painter. Canadian Gothic. And finally this rather bleak view of the graveyard at Sandwich Bay. Maybe this reminds me of Hitchcock more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. I still do that.
Well, from bleak Labrador to sunny Spain, Campbell, both Campbells, Elizabeth and Wallace, chose the center of the eclipse in northeastern Spain at Alhama de Aragon, in this beautiful valley of uplifted and eroded limestones, in which there was actually a sizable town, in this apparently medieval tower. Here they were enlisting local carters to take the eclipse gear up to this site, where they set up in a park adjacent to a palace that had been built actually for the Queen of Spain, because she was fond of hot springs, and there was a hot spring in the area. Unfortunately, at least at this time, the Queen had never shown up. They built it and hoped she would. However, they didn't let the Lick expedition use the empty palace, the unoccupied palace, and Elizabeth Campbell speculated that it was because not enough time had yet elapsed since the Spanish-American War, and though they could, you know, they welcomed them to Spain and let them set up outside, letting them into the Queen's palace was just going a little bit too far. Here you see, again, the Vulcan camera. You know, I looked at these plates for quite some time before it occurred to me, wait a minute, I just saw this in Labrador. Obviously, what they did was build several of them. And you also see the 40-foot tower there in the background. This is a close-up view of two of the moving plate holder spectrographs. And here's the Eclipse group. They brought an enormous amount of equipment to Spain. The outlying camps at the western and eastern extremes of the Shadow Path only had with them a Vulcan camera and some version of the 40-foot camera. But at the center of the Eclipse, Campbell brought all of his polarographs, his spectroscopes, and so forth. And they needed a very large group to man them. And so they had volunteers coming down from all over Europe. Here you see them, and again you see Campbell here and Elizabeth next to him, minus pith helmet. And in keeping with the tradition, and they made many nice views of Alhama de Aragon. The eastern arm of the expedition was sent to Elephantine Island at Aswan on the Nile, and led by William Hussey, who was another member of the Lick staff. Hussey was, I think, had the most unabashed prose style of any astronomer that I know of that time. He wrote of his approach to Egypt in the publications of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, which is usually fairly dry. He wrote, "The yellow shores of Africa stretched long and low in the face of a cloudless sky. The yellow bluffs were penciled with thin palms, erect, campanulate, like the wands that Cleopatra's women held when in these very waters she came down to meet the Roman galleys." How many astronomers write like that? I mean, it's a little over the top, but I found it quite charming. Again, here we have some of the local the local materials being used, the 40-foot tower is now covered in reed mats that were doubtless woven from reeds that were gathered on the Nile. And here we see the third version of the Vulcan camera being set up. It acquired the nickname in Egypt of the cross-eyed lady. And then there was this, and I thought, well, this is Egypt. That's got to be a mummy. I don't know if you've ever seen these mummified cats, for example, which were quite common in Egypt. Looked remarkably like that. Turned out just to be a telescope. Results were obtained in Spain and in Egypt, though in Egypt there was so much dust blowing up from the Sahara. It was, I think, 100 to 104 degrees, and the skies were sort of turning red from all this dust. But they got a few pictures. However, it was not enough to determine, at least down to a certain magnitude or below a certain magnitude, whether Vulcan existed, nor was the problem of the short-term variations in the corona solved. Had Hannah and her father to deconvolve the eclipse photographs, I think maybe he would have gotten some positive results. The most remote of the Lick expeditions, at least in terms of the difficulty of access and the length of preparation, was to Flint Island in the South Pacific. Flint Island is about 400 miles north of Tahiti. They couldn't get transportation there, and Campbell worked for almost two frustrating years in advance of the eclipse trying to get to Flint. They only had two choices. There were only two tiny atolls on which the eclipse made landfall, and Flint seemed the best in terms of weather, but it was tiny and virtually inaccessible. In the end, he went to the president of the University of California, who contacted the president of the United States, who ordered the Navy Department to requisition the ship Annapolis to pick up the group in Tahiti, where there was ease of access, and take them the 400 miles north to Flint. But they couldn't land at Flint because there was a reef all around, a coral reef, and so 40 tons of equipment. Now, Eclipses had grown more and more ambitious with time. 40 tons of equipment were offloaded in surf boats, all successfully and safely, along with the observers. And here we see Elizabeth sitting in front of her hut. They brought all sorts of canvas tents and so forth, but quickly discovered that these grass huts that had been built them, this was a coconut plantation on Flint, and the local workers built these much cooler and more comfortable huts for them. This, you can't see it, but written on the bottom of this plate in the emulsion, it says Elizabeth Ballard Campbell on Flint Island, Secretary of the Interior. Because she was, among her many other duties, not all of them domestic, she took care of the commissary and all of the food. So she was given that title. Here we see the equipment being set up in the jungle. There's the one of the moving plate spectrographs. And see that since nothing could be obtained at Flint, and not a nail or a screw, they had to bring absolutely everything, and they used the packing cases for the material to build the equatorial mounts. Here are now two of the Vulcan cameras that had served in 1905 set up. And you can see that they're pointing pretty high in the sky. This is the tropics. The eclipse was near noon, so it was almost directly overhead. They also brought with them as a guest from the Smithsonian Institution, Charles Greeley Abbott, who was very interested in the temperature of the corona, and he set up out on the beach and with his own equipment and his bolometer to try and measure the temperature and to understand why it was as hot as it was. I've always been intrigued by this thing, this sort of funnel that leads off into this pipe and then disappears into the jungle. To say that the Lick instrumentation was a bit inland. And I wondered if perhaps it was a speaking tube or maybe something for a time signal to be beaten out over the... or for both. Yeah. But obviously they innovated with local materials. This is perhaps the best known picture, and I expect many of you have seen this, of Elizabeth Ballard Campbell. It's a beautiful picture, is it, with her head framed first by the hat and then the umbrella and then the peak of the hut in the back, and then you notice what she's sitting on. What is less often seen is the more grisly side of that practice. I'm happy to report that Flint Island is now a protected refuge for breeding sea turtles. Clearly, it wasn't at the time. Here is again the 40-foot tower, looking almost straight up, and the a couple of spectrographs looking sort of like tikis in this context. Flint was a very successful eclipse, again one that was snatched from the jaws of the clouds at the last moment. Campbell wrote, less than a minute before totality, the slender crescent of the sun showed through the clouds, though a moderate rain was still falling. The clouds grew rapidly lighter, and the last drops of rain fell 2 or 3 seconds after the beginning of totality, and they pulled the canvases off of their equipment and got superb results. And among other things, Campbell felt that the Flint expedition had finally put to rest the question of the intermercurial planet, which of course now we know didn't exist. There was a long hiatus, 6 years until the next eclipse, the next Lick eclipse, which they attended at Brovary near Kiev in Russia. And Campbell went out of his way before leaving the San Jose area, the Bay Area, to tell a reporter from the San Jose Mercury News that it is scarcely necessary to say that an eclipse expedition is not a pleasure trip. I think he felt compelled to say so because he brought with him not only Elizabeth, as was his custom, but all three of his sons and his mother-in-law. I think there was an element of a pleasure trip to it. Not only that, but they brought all their usual camping equipment and ended up instead renting this rather luxurious dacha. Here's the equipment set up on the grounds. I can't help but see these as sort of environmental sculpture. I think that if there were an art historian, and I showed this to him or her and said, oh yeah, this is a hitherto undiscovered picture of a Russian constructivist sculpture show from 1914, she would believe me, absolutely. Now, I just got through telling you that the Vulcan question had been settled, and that the Vulcan, you think that the Vulcan camera would have been retired, and it was in a sense, but not completely. It was actually converted to what was now redubbed the Einstein camera. You can see that the tubes are no longer cockeyed. They become parallel and now take photographs of four fields all around the sun, with the idea, of course, of looking for deflection of starlight, as predicted in the then recently published papers by Einstein on relativity. His prediction and suggestion stars would be seen to be displaced by a certain amount of eclipses due to the bending of light and the gravitational field of the sun. He suggested that eclipse expeditions look for this, and Campbell decided that he wanted Lick to be the first. I think he hoped actually to refute it. He was not a fan of relativity. He liked the classical mechanics. Brovary, unfortunately, was clouded out. They did get some great pictures of the locals. Of course, you have to have a couple of cute kids. And here is further proof that that eclipse expeditions are no picnic. But in this case, actually, there were clouds other than those that had gathered over Brovary in the sky. This was August 1914, and within weeks of the expedition, war had been declared in Europe. And in fact, the Campbells witnessed the mobilization of the troops from Kiev. He wrote, some 10 days after starting life in the camp came the order for the Russian mobilization, and we shall always remember the long and sad procession of rude carts which passed the dacha early one morning, transporting the men of our little town to their mobilization depot. The scenes of parting with the wives and children were heartrending. Then came in quick succession those declarations of war which have embroiled Europe in a catastrophe, such that the wildest writer of fiction could not have predicted or imagined 6 months ago. And in fact, within less than a year, Campbell's eldest son was to join the services. He fortunately survived the war, but he became one of America's leading flying aces. The Eclipse group barely made it out of Russia. They had had the misfortune to be holding tickets out of Russia through Berlin and Paris. They couldn't have chosen really a worse itinerary for the way home. So they got out through Scandinavia and got to England and got a boat home. But the Eclipse equipment didn't fare so well. It ended up behind the lines in Russia for the duration of the war, being held at Pulkovo Observatory, and eventually returned. Goldendale, Washington, a North American eclipse in 1918 was the next. Thanks. I see I have 2 minutes, so I'm going to hurry a bit. We are getting very close to the end. Goldendale was Lick's second attempt to deal with the Einstein problem, but they had their own problem in that they didn't have the Einstein camera. It was back at Pulkovo, but they did build sort of a jury rig camera out of whatever they could find at the time to handle the Einstein problem. And it turned out that they had a good eclipse at Goldendale, but the camera was not up to it, and they got a lot of fields around the sun. And Trumpler, Robert Trumpler, the Swiss astronomer who was on the Lick staff then, and who was later very famous for dealing with the interstellar matter problems, reduced those plates and got a negative result. But Campbell decided that the plates were not good enough and that the result was in doubt, and not to go to press, which was a very wise decision, because of course the result was positive, as was found the next year by the British expedition that made the first plates to prove relativity. But in 1922 in Wallal, Lick resoundingly corroborated the British results. This is Trumpler on the beach at Wallal. And this is the camp at Wallal. Unfortunately, for some reason, there's no surviving picture of the entirely rebuilt Einstein camera, which got such wonderful results. But it is under that large tent just to the right of the 40-foot camera. So I will leave you with this rather charming picture taken actually the next year at 1923 in Ensenada, and hope that you have enjoyed this legacy of sort of visual and imaginative legacy of the eclipse. Thanks very much.
We've got time for a couple of questions.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful set of things. I certainly hope you arrange to publish it all.
Yeah, I do too. I've been hoping to for a long time, and I'm actually leaving Lick soon, and I will have more time to work on it. And though I've made the promise before, so I hesitate to make it now, but I hope within a year or two.
Alex Pong, who was supposed to be here but isn't, does have a book on Victorian Eclipse Expedition, so that's before this.
Yeah, I've not had the good fortune to meet Alex, but I know his books.
Let me make two more points. One is, obviously, we use much more compact eclipse equipment these days, and maybe I'm embarrassed about that a little bit. And should we be having 40-foot cameras, or is it really just that the CCDs and even the finer-grained film has really taken over from the from big plates, and maybe some of us will discuss that at the break. Let me just make two more quick points. Donald Menzel, as we discussed at lunch, I guess, yesterday, in 1931 published his analysis from three or four of those eclipse expeditions around 1900, crediting Campbell on the title page, and that's the main understanding we got of the chromosphere at that time. That's what made Menzel's name. And Menzel, of course, then went on a series of eclipse expeditions of his own. And when I went with him on my first professional expedition in 1970, he supervised building some equipment out of plywood and crates that we had around. And my job, in fact, was to be the shutter in which I held a piece of, the equivalent of styrofoam in front of the lens. Off and on, so I was reminded of that.
Oh, so we have a true shutter man here. Great.
Okay, so let's see. We're going to subtract 5 minutes off of Pasikoff's lecture. One more question.
Yeah.
I would like to know, what is the state of conservation of those original plates?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked it. Did you all hear what is the state of conservation of those plates? Lousy. And I have tried and tried and tried again to get money at least to provide a good climate control system for our plate vault and have failed. As I say, there is a sort of sense that this is an enormously important treasure, but that there is this sort of neglect. I think that the eclipse plates, at least this batch, should probably go to our special collections at the McHenry Library in Santa Cruz, because I don't see it happening. You know that Harvard is now digitizing all of their plate collection. I would like to see us follow suit, but I think it's unlikely. And I'm afraid our plight is the one that is common in most of the plate collections around the world. So, thank you.